just like to welcome everybody again for a second time to this week's instalment of the Digital Classicist Work in Progress seminar. It's nice to see familiar faces, and it's also nice to see new faces. So welcome to all of you. For those of you that are not familiar, these seminars are sponsored by the Institute of Classical Studies here in Senate House, University of London, and also by the Centre for Computing and Humanities at King's College, also in the University of London. We are sponsored by various people. You'll see some flyers scattered around the table, which have details of some of the projects we have at CCH and some of the other stuff that's going on. It also have, you'll see flyers there for the Centre for Computing and Humanities and Master's Degree programmes, so please feel free to take any of those that you wish. We have a variety of sponsors. One of also is the Centre for E-Research, and they've run out of paper plates, so apologies, we have no paper plates today, so you'll see goodies scattered around on the paper serviettes, but we'll have to go and raid their stock cupboard again next week, after the weekend. You'll also see on the table the programme we've got. After today, we've got three more sessions of these Friday seminars. Details of those you'll find on the programme. Please feel free again to take one of those and stick it up somewhere if you like. Next week's offering is from Charlotte Richet, who's with us today, from Stone to Byte, Implementations of XML Publications in Inscriptions. On announcements, I also have another new flyer, and this is one for the TEI, the Text Encoding Initiative, who have their 8th annual meeting of members consortium in November, and that's at King's College, is it CCH? We're hosting it at CCH.
Not Strand.
It's at the Strand. It's hosted by King's College London. So there's some flyers concerning that here, if you wish. And also, I'd like to remind you that we are recording all these seminars for podcasting. If you haven't yet done so, please go to our website. Just Google Digital Classicist if you don't have the address, or you'll see some cards laying around on the table. Take one of those, and you are free to download and listen to all the thrilling installments that you are not able to attend. And you might find something there that is of interest to you. But on that note, today's session is also being recorded, so if you don't want if you don't want to be recorded and broadcast internationally for everybody to hear, then it's probably best that you keep quiet. Yeah. But all audience contributions are most welcome in the questions which will follow the presentation. And today it gives me very great pleasure to welcome Juan Garces, late of CCH, Centre for Computing and Humanities, and we used to share an office together. And now he works the British Library, just up the road, so he has even less distance to walk than us. No, it's probably about the same, isn't it? We're probably midway, a very short distance. Anyhow, Juan is up at the British Library now, and he's curator of the Codex Sinaiticus, which he's going to be talking about today. And this is the book of the Bible. It's the oldest complete Greek Bible, yes? And this is the one that was found in the Sinai Desert, and Juan is going to tell us all about what they're doing to reconstruct, digitize, and publish.
Well, thank you very much. Wow, thank you very much for coming on such a beautiful sunny day with cricket and everything on. And anyway, I didn't expect that many. I've recycled some slides that I've used previously, so if some things that I say now are obvious to some, I apologize for that. They were intended for a slightly different audience, although some of us might not be very familiar with some of the issues. So basically, the next 40 minutes or so, I will be talking on these four points. Say a little bit about what kind of collaboration it is, because that has defined the project, the Codex Sinaiticus project, quite a bit. Of course, say something on Codex Sinaiticus itself. And then I will break down the work of the project a bit more. And last but not least, say something about the website, how we have presented Codex Sinaiticus online from last week. Right, so it all begins on the 9th of March 2005. Well, actually not. It starts 3 years before that with a good idea by a reader who comes to the British Library and says, wouldn't it be nice to digitize Codex Sinaiticus and put it online? And some people say, yeah, it would be nice to do that. And in fact, you know, conversations start, emails are changed, letters are written, invitations issued. And finally, 9th of March 2005, the four representatives of institutions that hold leaves, part of Codex Sinaiticus, got together, put pen to paper, and signed a partnership agreement. And that was a very big step, especially if you're ever so slightly familiar with the history of Codex Sinaiticus. And I think we're very proud of that, that all partners decided to put aside the differences and to approach this issue constructively and at least virtually reunify Codex Sinaiticus. Not only for partner institutions, there are many other collaborators. I understand that the word collaborators is a little bit of a funny connotation, but we've been working together with many. Just to single out four institutions, the Institute for Textual Scholarship and Electronic Editing at the University of Birmingham has been central in producing the transcription and the alignment. I will come back to that a bit later. The Institute for New Testament Textual Research in Münster is probably the largest editorial project in the world, simply because there are so many manuscripts of the New Testament, and so they had a very good input into this. And there were some other institutions like the Center for Retrospective Digitalization, Göttingen, Germany, and the Society of Biblical Literature in Atlanta. Also, we had quite a variety of funders, I guess, matching the collaborating institutions, coming up to £1 million in donations. Perhaps I should point out the HRC and the Deutsche Forschungsgemeinschaft. The HRC funded the transcription, and the Deutsche Forschungsgemeinschaft, the website. But there are many other funding bodies that have supported us. Also, very, very briefly, a complex project like this needs a complex organization. And this is just to give you an idea of how many working parties meetings there were yearly, and how many decisions had to be made on that, you know, through all the possible meetings and agreed, and that was quite interesting. So, what did we want to do? Well, our aims were basically to give global access to major manuscript treasure. If you want to see Codex Sinaiticus, and if you want to see all of Codex Sinaiticus, you would have to travel to four places, and getting to those places will not guarantee you having a look, never mind touching Codex Sinaiticus. I think guarantee you coming to the British Library, I think somebody was quoted saying, on bended knee, we would have to be asked. I'm sure that's pretty close to the truth. It's a book we very, very, with great difficulty, give access to scholars. You need a very, very good legitimating question that you can answer only by seeing Codex Sinaiticus. And we hope that those people needing to have a look at Codex Sinaiticus will be less and less with this project. Obviously, we also wanted to preserve it for the future, make sure that it's in a stable condition. I'll come back to that a little bit later. And also to research and understand better the content and the history of Codex Sinaiticus. And the means by which we were wanting to reach those aims were basically, and I think Digital Classicist in a way summarizes it very well, is scholarship aided by modern technology, and obviously close collaboration between a host of very different groups of experts coming also from very different backgrounds, and you know, never mind countries, languages, but also cultures. So, it was a very short introduction, but you get an idea of the framework. And now, perhaps the first principal part of my presentation. What is Codex Sinaiticus? Here's a nice opening. It's a bit distorted because the screen seems to stretch it a bit horizontally, but this is gives you a very nice idea. In fact, if you go to the British Library, to the Treasures Gallery, you will always find one of the two volumes that are currently at the British Library exhibited there. And so you can, you'll be able to look at it. So what is it? Let's start by what it contains. It's a Greek Bible, and it contains part of the Old Testament in Greek, obviously, which is commonly referred to as the Septuagint. It's a very interesting part of the textual tradition and transmission of the Bible, and I could talk for hours on this. It has been canonized by two religions and decanonized by both religions. So how did that happen? That's a very interesting story. It also includes books that you might not find in Protestant Bibles in the Old Testament, and I'm naming them here. It's 2nd Esdras, Tobit, Judith, 1st and 4th Maccabees, although what happened to 2nd and 3rd? Interesting question. Wisdom of Solomon and Ben Sira. It also contains the whole New Testament in Greek, and I'm not entirely sure whether to put it as an extra point or include it in the New Testament, because at the very end it includes two books you will not find in any other Bible as Bible, and that is the Epistle of Barnabas and the Shepherd of Hermas, both second century Christian writings. Shepherd of Hermas, very popular up to the fourth century, particularly in Egypt, where we found several fragments in Oxyrhynchus. Oxyrhynchus is beautiful because it gave us the opportunity to see what one community was reading, or rather more accurately, was throwing away. And gives us an idea of the books that were read more often and copied more often. And Shepherd of Hermas was more popular than some of the Gospels. Now this might be coincidence, but I think it's an indication of how popular it was. Now, why is it so significant? Well, obviously, it is significant because it is one of the oldest Bibles. Now, I have to qualify this. We usually like to say, simplifying a little bit, it's the oldest Bible, but there's a strong competitor in the Vatican called Codex Vaticanus, written, dated paleographically around the same time, sometimes a decade earlier, but how can you date paleographically by decades? Maybe you can, I don't know. So Codex Sinaiticus, Codex Vaticanus, more or less written around the same time. We like to say it's the oldest complete New Testament, and I think that's fair to say. So Codex Sinaiticus, some losses in the Old Testament, Vaticanus, some in the New. I already said this. And there are three topics on which I will talk very, very briefly. Where Codex Sinaiticus can shed some light in answering some of the questions. Well, I already said that it's one of the oldest books, and hence it's one of the most important witnesses of the Greek text of the Septuagint and the New Testament. That is very obvious, but it is also a very high quality text. It has a primacy of position in the lists that are consulted when reconstructing the New Testament and the Septuagint, referred to as Aleph or 01. You will also find these are two sigla most commonly used. Now, it is not, when you think about a manuscript, you might think of one text, but, and this is probably true for any or most manuscripts, if you look closer, you will actually find that there are layers upon layers of other texts, paratexts, corrections, and so on, that form part of the manuscript and create this multidimensional object in front of you. And this is particularly true of Codex Sinaiticus, because you will find corrections, no commentary, just corrections, ranging from the 4th century, that is from when it was written, by the first hand, or for the first hands, on the 4th century, up to the 12th century on Codex Sinaiticus, and that's very heavily so. And these range from alteration of one letter, so one letter is taken out, another one is added, to the insertion of whole sentences, whole verses on the margins. And I don't know of any other early Christian manuscript or any other early manuscript that has so extensively been corrected. And this is very interesting because it helps us understand the social life, if you like, of Codex Sinaiticus. What other manuscript has it come in touch with that it have left the traces on the manuscript, on the parchment pages, and hence understand the history of usage of Codex Sinaiticus, which is a little bit mysterious. So, now, the question of canon. Canon, the concept is, I hope, clear to everyone here. It refers to the list of authoritative books in the Christian Church. And it's fair to say that by the middle of the 4th century, there was a wide agreement over which books are part of that list and which are not. But this agreement wasn't complete, and it wasn't universal either. So understanding which books are in Codex Sinaiticus and why, beyond the ones you would expect as the core of a biblical Bible, or sorry, of a Christian Bible, is very interesting. Understanding the history of the canon, of how the group of books that make up the Bible came to be. It also is one of the earliest intact collection of such books, so a Bible, if you like. And it's therefore essential to understand the contents and arrangement of the Bible. So not only which book made it in, but also how they arranged, and so on and so forth. Now, I already mentioned the books that are included in the Old Testament, but not in the Hebrew Bible, or in the Protestant tradition of Old Testaments, and also the ones in the New Testament. And I will come back to some idiosyncratic sequence. For example, Hebrews is placed after 2 Thessalonians, and the Acts of the Apostles is between the pastoral and the Catholic epistle. If we have time and there's interest, I can come back to that a bit later. But also interesting is Codex Sinaiticus as a book, as an object, if you like. So not only as a text. Now, what is interesting to know, and many of you will know this, is that around the 4th century, Christians preferred the Codex over the roll. Now, this is quite interesting per se. It starts from the very beginning, really, of Christianity, that Christian scriptures were copied mostly, not solely, but mostly on codices, that is on folded gatherings of papyrus or parchment or indeed leather. And this is in contrast to earlier and most contemporary use practice around the time. And that's quite interesting. Now, parchment has a similar history in replacing papyrus, in that it was increasingly used as the writing support for literary texts from the 4th century onwards. So what happens with this? That we have strikingly few traces remaining of parchment codices produced before Codex Sinaiticus. So Codex Sinaiticus is really at a very important juncture of history in understanding how were books made at the time and how were they used. So it is an outstanding example of a parchment codex, and the binding structure is very interesting. The binding that you have nowadays, that you will find at the British Library, is not the original binding. So taking Codex Sinaiticus apart, or at least trying to look behind the existing bindings, the leaves in Leipzig, St. Petersburg, and Sinai are not bound, helps us understanding the binding structure. And that must have been one binding structure. I like to think of Codex Sinaiticus as the cutting edge of technology of the 4th century. Because think about it, 730 leaves bound in one structure. I think it's probably around the first time, and I might be bold in saying this, in the history of bookmaking, of Western bookmaking, that such a structure could be made. And that links very interestingly with the question of the canon, what books you fit in and what not. Because the amounts of books that are in Codex Sinaiticus, the amounts of books that can be held, reasonably well within a structure, are very much the same. All right. Well, coming back to Codex Sinaiticus per se, you get a little bit of an idea. This is a typical four-column page of Codex Sinaiticus. It measures around 380 times 345 millimeters, so it's relatively square, about this size, quite big, not a, you know, a pocketbook, but more a luxury Bible. It's written in a formal bookhand called Biblical Majuscule in Scriptura Continua, so one letter is written after the other. There are no spaces between the words. Obviously, you know, you're used to that from epigraphy. There's very little in terms of punctuation. There's hardly any other markings on the text that help you reading the text. The prose books that are written in four columns and the poetical books such as Psalms and so on, they're written in two columns, roughly double the size. And I'll show you some images of Psalms later on. And I already mentioned the multiple layers of corrections. Here's an extreme example. I like to show this because it gives you an idea of what is happening on the margins. It's a whole conversation going on. So here you have the first hand, you know, three of the four columns. This is a leaf 12 recto, which is in Leipzig, Germany. And you have a corrector thinking very strongly that surely at this point we should add this verse here, and so on. And some of the corrections are purely orthographical. Some names are corrected, I see. But some are quite substantial, and that is very interesting in terms of research and understanding. So where is Codex Sinaiticus? Well, just over 400 leaves are extant. We guess about 730 leaves were part of the original Codex Sinaiticus. And these are distributed between four places. The lion's share, 347 leaves, are the British Library. 43 leaves are the Leipzig University Library in Germany. 12 leaves and 40 fragments. Now, the fragment counts grows every time I ask. That's the latest number, and very exciting. Are at St. Catherine's Monastery in Mount Sinai. And fragments of five, or possibly six, we're still trying to figure out how fragments fitting together. They're still the National Library of Russia in St. Petersburg. And how this happened is really a very interesting thing. We had the website launch last week, and to our surprise, because we wanted to make it a soft launch. But I think the one mistake was that one of the big news agencies got hold of the story, and suddenly they were all over us. So there were many interviews, and the main question was the history. And I can't tell you too much, but I can tell you some corner facts that might help you understand a little bit. It all starts, as far as we can reconstruct, at Mount Sinai, which is in the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt. And there's the oldest continuously existing monastery. It's an Orthodox, Greek Orthodox monastery. And Codex Sinaiticus, we can say, has been most of his life at that monastery. In the 19th century, a German biblical scholar, how else could it be, starts traveling the Mediterranean coasts in search for biblical manuscripts. And that one of those trips leads him to Mount Sinai in 1844, where he identifies as being very valuable the 43 leaves that are nowadays at Leipzig. So 1844, 43 leaves come to Leipzig. But he comes back 1853 and is very disheartened because all he finds is a little fragment of Codex Sinaiticus, according to his story, right, that was used as a bookmark. So he wasn't very hopeful to finding more leaves of Codex Sinaiticus. But 1859, on his last trip, he, and on the last night, again according to his story, he is asked to one of the cells of one of the monks and sees there the 347 leaves that are now at the British Library. And how this came to St. Petersburg is a very long story, and I can't tell you too much because that is, as I would like to say, under investigation right now, and I'm not allowed to say too much. So what else happens? 1933, Russia is not any longer Russia, but the Soviet Union, and Stalin is in charge. And Soviet Union is in need of two things, well, one mainly, and that is foreign currency. And one thing they probably don't need as badly is Christian Bibles. So they put it on the market, and the British government decides to buy Codex Sinaiticus for £100,000. Now that in 1933 was quite a lot of money, half of which was raised by public appeal. So 50% were paid by the state, £50,000 were paid by donations, basically. Now if you go online, there's beautiful footage, like historic footage in black and white, fast moving, about how that happened. I won't be showing you anything here. Now, if you paid attention, you might ask, so, okay, this goes here, this goes there, and then there. How come they still have some leaves in St. Petersburg? Well, again, long story, but basically, that wasn't a part of the leaves that were purchased by the then British government and the British Museum. Very shortly, oops, no, that's not what I wanted. How do I go back? Okay, there's something missing here, sorry.
Some fragments,
quite a lot. It happens in 1975, it happens in Mount Sinai. Doing reconstruction work at the monastery, a roof collapses, roof/wall, I'm not entirely sure, and a hidden chamber is uncovered with quite a group of manuscripts containing, amongst them, 12 leaves of Codex Sinaiticus and about 40 fragments. And they are part of what they call nowadays the new finds. So this is how we do have the situation of one manuscript that originally belonged together being distributed over these four institutions. And obviously the project wanted to put them together again. Now, this history, or what I left out, is one of the more interesting parts of the Codex Sinaiticus project, and I'm afraid it's one of the parts that will be disclosed at the very end of the project. And that has to do with the nature of that history. But I can tell you that an account of how this came to be will be agreed, hopefully, and distributed. That's quite a task. Research has been undertaken already, and a report has been commissioned, and the draft of it already exists, and we hope to distribute it over the website and the other print publication. I already talked about this, so we'll jump over this slide and over this, and come to the project per se. There are roughly five strands of the project. There are a few more, but these are the main strands. And I already talked about the history, and I would like to talk a little bit about the conservation of Codex Sinaiticus. This is a beautiful image, the one you might have seen on the posters for this talk. This is a split, which is not a tear, I've been told. And it's just one of the many beautiful detailed shots that have been taken as part of the project. And I'm intending to publish them too on the website. This is one of the things that surprised me quite a bit, as a little aside. And that is the amount of amazing pictures that are taken by different departments that for the first time are really put together, because they're often not related. You know, one department knows what pictures they took for what purposes. And I think this is a great chance to put them together, to relate them to each other and make them accessible, because each angle, each picture adds something, I think, to answer particular questions. This is a less well-preserved leaf, one of the 12 leaves that were found in 1975. You can guess that more work was needed here. Now, work in terms of conservation started already in the 30s, when, well, it probably started earlier than that, but modern conservation work started in the 30s when it came here to London. Here's a shot of 347 leaves when they came here to London from the side. It's from here. And this is how they were stretched at the time. It looks quite horrible. It looks like a torture instrument almost. But as I understand, Douglas Cockerell, one of the leading conservators at the time, was commissioned to conserve and preserve Codex Sinaiticus, and he decided to have this approach to it. And these are the binding structures that he commissioned and did in the mid-30s, and they are nowadays in one very nice snap box in the vaults of the British Library. I'll come back to this. Just say something quickly on this. Again, conservation, as any other strand of Codex Sinaiticus of the project, had to be done in collaboration. So the parts that are at each location couldn't leave the location, and work had to be undertaken in partnership and at situ, in situ. So there was an initial assessment of each leaf, because we had to make sure that before they're digitized, they are stable enough and they can be preserved for the future. But there also was a detailed assessment, and that detailed assessment we have put online, and we'll add to that. And basically, it was a group of conservators going through each leaf and observing each little feature, if you like. And just to go back and give you an idea, these are the six categories they would categorize their features. So they would, sorry, the first one is the unreadable. That move. It happens to correspond to the colors they used in the Excel sheet, but it means parchment. So the parchment is obviously the most important one. But they also observed features about the scribes from a conservation point of view, codicology of how the book was put together or not, the history of previous treatments, the current condition, and any repairs that had been undertaken on Codex Sinaiticus, the condition of those. So let's move forward. The policy was to do as little conservation work as needed. So that was planned by the Conservation Working Party, one of the many parties, and the outcome was documented, as I said, and distributed not only in the website and some of the other outputs, but also in four languages, which are the languages of the four partners. Here's a very unflattering picture for two reasons. It stretched twice, stretched because I stretched on my slide and stretched again, but just to give you an idea of some of the faces behind one of the teams. Now, if you do a Google Images search online a couple of months ago, or even a week ago, I guess, you would find most likely something like this. Now, admittedly, this is not the best image I found online. There were a few better ones. But it's fair to say, as you know, all of them were of low resolution. They were usually taken from a print facsimile that was published in 1911 and 1922, the New Testament, 11, the Old Testament. And quite often, they're not attributed. So we don't know anything about the source. Now, we obviously wanted to address this by photographing all the leaves to the highest specs. But photographing a parchment book is not as straightforward as I would have thought before I joined this project. One question is, for example, on what background do you photograph parchment? It makes a big difference. And you can see here some of the test images we took early on in assessing what would be the best in terms of background. On the left you see a near background, and the readability of the test, obviously the resolution is too low, you won't be able to read it in this size, but the readability of the text is very, very good, but the parchment color is grayed out and totally distorted. It will give you a very bad impression of the parchment. You get almost the opposite on the other extreme you have very accurate colors, but very bad readability. So obviously the solution would be somewhere in the middle. Desert brown, I don't know what you call this color, but you know, a color quite close to the parchment was chosen as a compromise between the two extreme colors. This is a good example because it's the flesh side. Each parchment leaf has a flesh and a hair side. And on one of the sides, the ink sticks better and the writing is more clear. And obviously, that is important in terms of making it accessible. So this is the flesh side, not as readable as the other sides, the other side. And the color we decided to go for as a background. Just some, you know, for the techies amongst you, the technicians, some kind of data. We use 600 dpi resolution. That's a bit of a misnomer, and I won't go deeper into that, but it gives you an idea about what quality it is. We used phase one scanning rack, some of the best in the market, and we used uncompressed TIFF as with embedded metadata as the master copies. What you will see online, unfortunately, is not the TIFFs, and I'll come back to that and explain a bit more. So again, like conservation, all the leaves were digitized at each venue. After conservation, we were informed by scholarly review of late facsimile, i.e. what do scholars want from a facsimile. We try to employ optimal methods and minimal handling. And I already said something about the images. I should have taken this out, this is not longer true. But there are different ways of putting light onto a leaf. The standard, you would think, is to have an equal distribution of light over the page, so you can read all the features. But that is not always the best approach if what you're interested in is really the parchment, the material. So alongside the standard light images that we have put up, we also shot a second series with a raking light, which is basically a light at a very low angle from one of the corners. And you'll see some of the features that you're able to see that you wouldn't be able to see otherwise. Now, the intended use of the images was obviously to put it out as part of the website, but also to pass it on in the workflow to the next step, and that is the transcription of Codex Sinaiticus. This was led by ITSI, by the Institute of Textual Scholarship and Electronic Editing, in collaboration with the Münster Institute. And the key elements were, we wanted to make a transcription to put them alongside the images, so that searchable, that the text can be used in further research. But also we wanted to make that transcription in a way that it captures all the corrections, and that hadn't been done up to now. You have reasonable good additions of the base layers, but not so good additions or transcriptions rather of the corrections. Here's a screenshot of the screens one of the transcribers sent to me, and it's very straightforward. Basically, we sent them the images, and there were two of them working, transcribing the same text, and that transcription, those transcriptions were then automatically compared, and where they differed, they went back and double-checked on who was right, who was wrong, if that could be solved. What you have on the right is a proprietary piece of software developed by ITSI, but the transcription was later on converted into, you might be glad to hear, TI-compliant XML, and we hope to make that downloadable from the website too, having learned from other projects that have done that. Just to give you an idea how other projects have put up their transcriptions, this is a screenshot from Münster, and they've been working for years already on this. It's a better version, it's not a full version, but you can see some of the elements we have taken over for our website and perhaps I'll explain them later on better. Now, the website was developed in Germany simply because they got the funding, right? Not because they are better or worse. There was a tender process, and it was won by a firm called ACS Solutions, who cooperated with another firm called 3Point Concepts, who did the design. It will soon migrate to the British Library, and we have committed ourselves to maintain and to preserve the website into eternity. Well, as far as you can say that with any electronic preservation project. It's free to view, as you might have discovered already. And perhaps different to websites I've been involved with previously, it is really directed at many different readers, not only the scholars. And that was quite a challenge for me personally, because you have to take totally different questions into consideration. You can't take certain things for granted that you would with scholars and so on. I could come back to that later on. All right. There were some specifications. These are not all of them. These are just some key ones. And that is, our idea was to bring together a variety of data sets and integrate them into a unified user interface. Now, what are these data sets? They were obviously the digital images of the leaves. There were XML files for the transcription. There were Excel spreadsheets for the physical description. There were XML files for the translation, a slightly different schema. And all those, and I've left some out, had to be integrated into this website somehow on the back end. We also made a decision that since the British Library has committed itself to preserving this, the technologies and the standards supported by the British Library had to be the ones really used here. And this is not a question of better or worse technology, but simply a very practical decision we made early on. In order to ensure accessibility and long-term maintenance, we also decided no plugins. Now, plugins would have made things much, much easier, as I discovered not too late. In that it's very easy to create, well, it's easier to create a flash site or a Silverlight site, flash like Sumify or similar software. Instead, we decided to go for web standards. That is, you know, HTML, CSS, in terms of standard text, static text, that is, and JavaScript, XML, Ajax, in order to make it more interactive. So also, we thought the way we want image and text representations of Codex Sinaiticus pages presented online had to be unique, because I think it hadn't been done before. But you might tell me otherwise later on. Right, so what happened? On the 24th of July, we went live. And it was supposed to be a soft launch. I said that previously. And it didn't turn out as soft as we thought. There were quite a few things. And you can see some of the main topics of the press. I learned a lot, especially what Reed quoted about somebody must not always be the truth. I mean, anyway, I won't get started here. But what you see quoted as Juan Garcés saying wasn't always what Juan Garcés said. It's as simple as that. I don't know how they reconcile that. But what advantage of going live so soon, and let me backtrack one step. So we went live on the 24th of July, but what you see there on the website is not the final product. It's the first release, if you like. It doesn't have all the leaves. It has some of them. It has all the leaves from Leipzig and Psalms and books, which are, Psalms and the Gospel of Mark, which are in London. But there's quite a lot of Codex Sinaiticus missing. It also doesn't have all the functionality yet, but we thought it would be a good idea. And I think the next two slides really represent the fact that this might be a very good idea. I guess with print, you tend to put out the perfect, complete publication. With a website, there might be an advantage of not doing that. And this is one of them. This happened 2 days later, 2 days after the website. This person didn't have access to the website previous to the launch. And we have an in-depth, very good as in very in-depth, good not necessarily in only positive. There was some good constructive criticism. We have the first review online 2 days after, and within a week, the second. And those contain really good pointers to how to improve the website within a week. And I think it's also safe to say we will take those into consideration when we go live with the second release in November this year and the final website in July 2009. I'm talking a bit longer than I hoped, but let me show you very quickly the website. This is it. So this is a homepage. It has a search facility up there. There's a little bit of introduction. What is Codex Sineticus, if you want to know. There's a bit more information about the project. There are lots of little detail shots that are quite interesting, if you like to look closer. This is a scar tissue. So the animal out of which the parchment was made had a scar. The parchment was stretched as part of the production of the parchment and scraped. And this is the feature you can see when there was a scar previously. Very, very interesting. And I guess this is the main interface. Now, I remember, I know I'm being taped here, but I remember people saying, make sure that the site doesn't crash on the day, you know, make sure. So we did stress testing, we used special software to emulate hundreds of thousands of users. And what happened? The site crashed. It was down for several hours the first day and overnight the second day. And the reason really is, in our boldest dreams, we would have not counted for so many users. I don't know if they're official numbers, but on the first 2 days, I've been told there were between 3 and 5 unique IP addresses accessing the website. And it would take something like, I don't know, Google to cope with something like that, such an awesome 3 to 5 million. 3 and 5 people, yeah. Hence it crashed. Yeah, no, so that is a very good success story. The interface is a bit complex. There's a website that explains a lot. There's also some information. Every time you see an eye on the website, there's some additional information that tells you about the boxes. Let me start on the top. Obviously, you can jump directly to a book of the Bible. There are only a couple of them up yet. Or to a chapter within the book, or even to a verse. You want to see the page where your favorite verse is, let's say, or the verse you want to do research on, or something like that. If you're a little bit more of an expert, you might go directly to the page. You know it's not, so we are from the semantic to the physical. You know it's choir 38, 1 recto you want to look at. And you can do this on this search menu. And basically there are four display boxes. They're not windows. And you only see three now, I'll show the fourth. And they're basically the image, a transcription, I'll make them bigger in a moment, and a translation. Was a bit of a surprise for us because originally we didn't plan to make too much of a translation. We only wanted to translate selected passages. But every second email I've received since the launch was, where is the translation? And this goes again in the direction that it makes a lot of sense to make this kind of publication, even though it might be of particular interest to scholars, make it accessible to wider audience. And this wider audience will not necessarily know Greek well enough to go directly to the transcription. There is translation to an English one to South, for example. Here it is. Now let me make this a bit wider, and let me get rid of the translation. Oops, no, the transcription of it. The translation I want to get rid of. Let me go back to the very beginning. So most of these display boxes you can arrange in a way that is more suitable to what you want to do. If you want to do only, you know, if all you want to do is looking at images, you only want this window open, and you maximize and the space on the window, and you can zoom in and, you know, drag it around and look to whatever you want to look at. If you're more a textual scholar, you might be interested to look at the transcription mainly, and only take the image if you want to double check a particular transcription. Now, image and transcription are closely linked in that you can double click on a word here and it will jump to the place on the image and circle it in red for those who you know are not used to read Greek in Scripta Continua. It works the other way too. Let me try. Does it? Yes. Here we are. That was quite a thing to get going. This is work in progress. It can be improved in many ways. And one of the things I'm sure we can improve on is how to display the corrections. Here's an example. There's a little blue sign. I don't know whether you can see the blue color. Just about. But the rule is, if you see something in blue on the transcription, there's an additional information, usually a correction. So I go over this chi, and it is a kappa alpha originally, and somebody has added a corrector called S1, not a very inventive name, had added a iota to make chi out of it, and so on and so forth. Here you have an addition, or a corrector called D, added a short phrase, and so on and so forth. Very briefly, before we go into a question, yeah. Now, I'm not sure I can show you something that works well, but let's give it a shot. This is one of the, you don't want to. Let's do this. This is one of the parts that surely we'll need some further work. Let's put this more in the center. You see, there's some areas identified on the parchment, and those help identifying where certain features are. If there's certain parchment features, that's a bad example. There's, for example, a previous repair. Okay, this is. In Germany, they call this Vorführ effect. Ah, there we are. Okay. So basically what it does, it highlights in red the part that has been repaired. And you can later, you know, zoom in on that part and verify yourself. Doesn't want to. Let's do it this way. Where the repair was. And I think this is the sign of a parchment repair done in 1935 by Douglas Coverdell. Anyway, I could go on for hours, but I think it's a good time to go into question mode and perhaps entertainment mode too.
I think so. Thank you. Thank you, Juan. Yes, I look forward to exploring the site myself. A couple of things. One quite important thing that I missed in the introduction, because it was so obvious to me that I didn't mention it, but I should say that Juan was actually one of the original founders of the Digital Classicist, and that's why it's especially nice to welcome him here today. I forgot to mention that at the beginning. It was just so obvious to me. The other thing I would like to...
It really hurt.
Oh, so you forgot all about your time with us, didn't you? The other thing that I'd like to say is that I've been looking at one's monitor screen rather than the screen, the display out there. And what looks great there always ends up looking pretty scrappy up on the screen by the time it's gone through the projector. And there are some great images, both on the PowerPoint, which I hope you're going to let us put on the website. PowerPoint will be going up on the website complete with images, along with the podcast, and also the actual images that are coming from the website are really tremendous, and they're far better than the ones that everybody else is seeing up there on the screen. So I'm having a special preview down there. But for your presentation, I was writing down lots of questions, and you covered almost all of them as you went through, which is always a good sign of a good presentation. But I just like to comment on two things that I particularly liked about this. One was the fact that you have made it available for so many different interests, not solely for textual scholars. I think that is really great. And also the casual interest as well, making it available for a wider audience. And also, perhaps unintentionally, but the ability to have user feedback in your early construction age, I think it's got to be a really good thing. That way you're getting free usability testing by the public. That's excellent. But an actual question for you. Yeah, this is very complex. How much of your 370, however many pages, are actually up there? And what do you see as a timescale for getting the whole thing up there?
They're roughly around 200 plus pages on.
Those you already have 200 pages?
Yeah.
Really?
Okay. And by July 2009, that is less than a year's time, all the Codex Sinaiticus pages will be up.
Oh, really? Excellent. Thank you. No, it just looked, the amount of work that you were doing, it looked like it was going to be much longer, but that's really good to know.
Well, I mean, there were many strands to it, but most of the strands are already finished. I mean, the whole codex, except for the Sinai leaves, have been digitized. Mm. They've all been transcribed already. The conservation work has all been done. So it's, from now on, in terms of website, from now on, it's more of the same and improving what is there, if you know what I mean. More of the same in adding more pages, more information, and improving the functionality, getting rid of some bugs, and so on.
Great project. The floor.
I noticed Cockerill's repairs there to the edge of the parchment, but what about other ancient and modern tears to the actual parchment, and how were they dealt with?
Well, I mean, there are pre-Cockerill repairs, and they are just recorded as any other repair in the physical descriptions. So the physical description is not searchable right now, so you couldn't find it out very quickly, but we hope by the end of the project you would have an interface that, you know, if that is your particular interest, you can search for particular features, as it will be possible to look for certain scribal features too, or even scribes, as far as we can identify. So if you want to search, you know, for repairs in general, or repairs that were done before by Cockerill, by us, as part of this project, you will be able to find them. And they have been treated in the same way, as in, they were recorded and described briefly, and so you can quickly find them and have an overall impression of how Codex Sinaiticus was treated in during its history.
The other thing is, does the original have any holes in it, or that make photographing difficult? I mean, for instance, I've been working on a 9th century text which has holes in there and damaged the text, and the Morgan Library has photographed right through about three or four pages without any backing.
Oh, I see.
What do you do about that sort of thing?
Well, I mean, I guess the answer to this would be, now, this is a funny picture, don't laugh, but the main item is in the background, so this is a post picture too. But it's this digitization rack. And you see what this is not Codex Sinaiticus, obviously. It's the facsimile, but it shows you what we did, and that is the rack is like this. It's flat here. There's on the background. There's a ramp going like this, and then there's another one at 90 degrees, 45 to the, and this one has suction on the edges. So what you do is you open the page, the leaf, and you can regulate the suction very, very carefully. This was developed by an Austrian, Manfred Meyer, and you can regulate the suction and stabilize the page. This also helps if it's cockled or somehow distorted. Otherwise, you can keep it still without putting any unnecessary pressure on it. And this, in this case, we had the background paper underneath. So a hole per se wouldn't have caused much of a problem. There would have been a loss. And behind it, you would have seen the background paper. What caused a little bit more problems was when there were folds, basically, and stretching the parchment would have possibly endangered the parchment. Sorry, the material. This happened, for example, or apparently happened with the Sinai leaves. You saw the image before. So some of that was obviously kept under circumstances beyond the control of anyone. And hence, there was some conservation work done on them. There was some very gentle stretching, but that was a bit of a challenge in terms of digitization, because you don't want to stretch it and risk damaging. I think the most important aspect was preserving and not damaging. So this is an interesting point, because I think that again, technology is advancing, again, we look at parchment leaves or a manuscript as a two-dimensional object, but clearly it isn't. It's an object that changes with conditions, and that is really three-dimensional, and there are ways of capturing three dimensions with parchments, and perhaps that would be something we'll consider in the future, not for Codex Sinaiticus, but for other manuscripts in the British Library. Very, very roughly the same, except that we have a complete New Testament, and the Vaticanus is not complete in the New Testament, but it's far more complete in the Old Testament. I think, I believe it's near complete. So, it's much of a muchness in terms of amount of text. But
is the New Testament, would there be more Gospels than
the No, I think it's fair to say that the hardcore of the canon had been established by the 4th century, where there were still variations were at the margins, and usually at the end of the New Testament you will find different books. Both Sinaiticus and Vaticanus have revelation, but then there are further books. I mentioned the Sinaiticus, Barnabas and Hermas, Vaticanus has Clementine epistles, first and second Clementine. So you will find slightly different Old Testament apocryphal books. I don't remember Vaticanus off the top of my head. But we have first and fourth Maccabees. And second and third Maccabees usually are part of the Septuagint. So they're likely to be found in other Bibles.
Because I heard that the one in the Vatican deliberately eliminated some of the Gospels that they had in the Gospel
Right. No, Gospel of Gospel of Judas is a Coptic gospel that was written, you know, a few centuries. It was written before these Bibles were made. No doubt about that. But if you talk about deliberately taken out, surely you couldn't prove that in the making of these Bibles, because there's no table of contents to say here's the Gospel of Judas and suddenly there's something missing. Or a pagination that goes through and suddenly there's some pages not there. In fact, the three big early Bibles, Vaticanus, Sinaiticus, and Alexandrinus, also at the British Library, they're all beautiful choir Bibles. So you get usually four double sheets folded, sewn up. That's one choir. You have many of those. In the case of Sinaiticus, 93 choirs. And those choirs are numbered. And so we know we have a pretty good idea about sequence, but also about any possible missing choirs. And the only missing, well, apart from the big losses in the Old Testament, the only missing choirs is one. It's between the Old and the New Testament. And we like to think that the reason for that is that it didn't contain biblical texts. It contained the Eusebian canon tables, which was an early way of segmenting the texts of the Gospels and making them comparable, putting them side by side. So this story in Matthew is the equivalent of this story in Mark, and so on and so forth. But it's certainly not true to say, at least for these Bibles, that some text has been deliberately taken out. There's no proof of that. I think what you might be referring to is the fact that there were Gospels that were not canonical and that the main church decided not to include them into the canon. That decision might have been taken deliberately. That might be true. In fact, we know that is true. But that happened relatively late. No, just the four. Yeah. I mean, remarkable is that verses 9 to 20 of the final chapter of Mark are not there, and they are meant not to be there. We know the ending of the book because you find these beautiful. It's a little bit of the coronis at the end of a book. That's very interesting to compare them across. It's one of the indicators of different scribes, because there are certain patterns to them. So you find the coronis at the end of Luke and John, very similar. It is a bit more faded. And contrast the coronis in the other two Gospels, quite different. But this is a clear marker. This is the end of the Gospel, right? After this, you won't find any more text. In the Gospel of John, there's something interesting. And that is, that must have happened while the ink was still wet, and that is that the scribe thought he or she had finished and writes the final coronis and notices, oops, there are some verses missing, so quickly get rid of it. There's still a remainder of it. Under strong UV light, you would see it, and we hope to put up UV pictures of that. And you can see the original ending of the correction on top. So there's that going on.
One foot, you and Tom deserve, and everyone deserve the congrats.
Thanks.
Let me try and play this with that.
Okay. I was expecting that. The way you started.
What you think is a bigger project, digitizing project.
Yeah.
Classics or otherwise. Yeah. You think the theology of the time, what have they done conceptually? What research questions have they made possible that were not possible?
Right.
For their existence. perhaps. Well, this has to do with certain psychological, with the introduction of certain aspects of statistics, perhaps, with the foundation of knowledge in the sense that, that intertextuality looks different once you have the ability to scan the whole corpus and extract the references. And a whole range of other new research questions, certain aspects that radically rephrase the relationship between type and token in tech, a whole range of new research questions that are simply not there until you have the digital option.
Sure.
What is the new research question that you think that your project enables? And surely it's not the fact that it's less costly. Yes, I would pay a lot of money if I had to go to St. Catharines and then St. Petersburg. It's very nice that the British Library saves the money of not that many scholars, but some scholars. But I'm sure you wouldn't describe the value of this project as a kind of cost-saving exercise in terms of the travel of scholars.
Mm.
What new research questions do you anticipate that this project enables?
That's a very good question. Let me come back to the travel. We worked very closely with Institute for Nordic Assembly of Text Forschung in Münster. And they're the leaders in producing the standard New Testament edition, critical edition. And as far as theology students are concerned, you know, that's the Bible, that's the New Testament, right? Most of them, in any case, the more discerning might disagree on certain decisions. So you think, you know, and they've been existing for many years, many decades, possibly even centuries. And you think that they got it right, right? They have a full transcription of Codex Sinaiticus without any mistakes. And the fact is, you will always find smaller mistakes. Because we got their transcriptions, we compared them, so we could really do some good quality control. And you might think, why is that so? And the short answer is, if Codex Sinaiticus would have been in their bookshelves, right, they would have just gone to it and double-checked on that, and they would have corrected it by now. But it's not. It's really difficult to access. And hence, that's not an issue that should be sidelined too much. But coming back to your question, this is not something which will be part of Codex Sinaiticus project. Codex Sinaiticus project is simply putting it out and creating the resource that possibly makes future research possible. But we're not going to research it, at least not using those resources to the best, because that is something which is the outcome of the project rather than the resource we're working with. So we're doing research, but not the final resource. I think one interesting...
I don't know, when I sit on the AHRC committee that gives money, the basic question which determines I give money or I don't give money.
Let me answer.
What research question do you answer?
Yeah.
Why does somebody give money if there's no research?
Well, the research question you answer in terms of not textual criticism, that is evident, but would be in the area of paleography. Having digitized these texts and being able to sample and closely compare is, I think, an area, and you've been working in that area, that is surely really waiting for a critical mass of digitized manuscripts. To be, you know, just to spring to life, really. If you look at Codex Sinaiticus, for example, you will find Tischendorf said he found four scribes, right? Then there was an in-depth study in the late 30s that said, oh, there are only three scribes. He distinguished two that are not really too different. We have decided that there are four scribes, four different scribes to what Tischendorf said. So I think there's quite a lot to be learned from being able to sample and juxtapose and maybe even use algorithm to, you know, describe patterns of certain letters to answer these questions. We won't be answering them. We have answers to the question how many scribes, you know, are there some disagreements with other transcriptions and so on and so forth. How was this book put together and so on and so forth. Those are the questions we will answer. But the answers we hope in the future will be answered with this resource have to do with using them, you know, taking them further, doing something with them, with the text. And I think one of the aspects that are important is we need a critical mass of these resources. So one book alone is obviously not enough, because you need comparative material. I think it's safe to say that that is around the corner. So. It's a good question. I didn't just...
There's some of it to buy.
Sorry.
In the call, wisdom of funding bodies should be not to predetermine any questions, but to enable creation of such resources to open it up to questions to people, to scholars, and any online resource usually proves that there's no end to new questions. Mm. They sometimes don't even cross the line with those who plan these.
I share your idealism. I doubt that is something that...
But I have a more practical question.
Okay.
One of your slides says that the codex was...
Yeah. Well, technically...
What do you mean?
Well, technically it was scanned. If you have a digital back like the Phase 1 P45, you can take single shot photography.
Non-contact digital photography.
Yeah, it was non-contact, but it literally went through.
Because there was this a little bit misleading.
Right.
You might think that it was photographer.
It's a type of camera that they're using. It's a scanning camera. It has the lens
like,
something
like
that focuses. But the bit that actually takes the image is a little scanner that runs across the top of it. So it's not that the document itself or the manuscript is going on the scanner. The camera itself has a little scanner on the top of it.
It's
scanned in that sense. Yeah.
That's fair enough. It's maybe a bit misleading. But it was a capture process that was a bit slower because it went line for line. And I just refer to the scanning. But strictly speaking, it's digital photography.
You look up, it's the same as the one they have in the Morn, slightly
yes.
different system. The one that you're familiar with in the Morn probably,
yes.
again, has a ability to come up and down and make it look. And that's the focusing element. But the bit that actually does the image capture is that little bit that takes 60 seconds to run across the top of the screen and then we does it. We have to agree.
Actually, that was another problem that evidence for the focal length had been changed between folios, and it was quite difficult because I was working with a much greater reflection on the
subject.
You've messed up the settings.
And it messed up the settings, yeah. So it was extremely difficult to actually try and capture what was reflected from what.
I think that is one of the issues that concern me in view of the near future, and that is digitization standards. I mean, we went out of the way to have a technical standards committee with top digitization experts and agreeing, okay, let's only use top equipment and so on and so forth. And different equipment, different results. You know, the colors are slightly different. And we know they're different because we use the identical background paper and the identical color, what do you call it? You know what I mean? The color patch on the side.
Yes.
So that we still haven't decided whether to do post-processing and assimilate them to each other. But that is an issue. I mean, it is an issue, it isn't. Some people are only interested in the text and they don't mind, and I guess a black and white image would be good enough for them. But I think since we are in the business of creating surrogates, and we are technologically advanced enough to create surrogates, then certain aspects are even superior to the original. You can do things to it and with it that you couldn't do, never dreamed to do. It's really important that we look into those standards and read them across institutions.
Okay, just like to comment on something Alice said, and this is actually to take it further, making, I think, such an important manuscript that is available to the mass public online. The number of hits you've had, several million in the first day, making the whole system crash. I mean, these are not scholars. This is the broad, wide interest of people. And
there are not so many scholars.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I say, the interest that you're going to have on anything that's going to be connected with a Christian Bible, and also you take into account and you add to that the newspaper headlines, what was it, the dodgy history of these Bibles, it's going to create more and more and more interest. And you're going to get a tremendous amount of scholarship, I think, around that as well, on the history of it. But also making it available to the wider general audience, I think, is a tremendous thing. There was another question
over here. Well, we got covered with a different answer, except that I'll add a bit to it, if I may, just as I worked out, because I can't do millimetres, and it's 16 by 14. Is that roughly in inches? Is that anything like right?
Roughly, that 16 rings.
16 by 14.
I read this morning in a website, not our website. I think it's 16 times something else. Yeah.
Okay. And if you go back to the 730 leaves that were originally there, what sort of weight would that be, given that there would have to be binding on top of it? How much would a parchment leaf weigh? Something proportional to
very large.
Ounce. Yes. I mean, obviously, if you start getting numbers up to, as I started getting, 6 or 8 pounds, it's obviously a ceremonial thing that you put on a stand.
Which raised the question, what was the purpose of a Bible like Codex Sinaiticus?
Yes.
A Bible that, furthermore, doesn't seem to have the common signs of heavy usage.
Yes.
There's some signs of usage. It seems to me more of a scholarly kind. So,
which makes the editing what goes into it in the first place.
Interesting. I mean, why is it so heavy corrected? Other Bibles don't have that.
And what are the corrections based on as well?
Yeah.
Where are they getting the corrections
from? They get them. Yeah, that's a very good question.
You expect the best scholars would have started it off rather than the...
Well, I mean, I won't go into New Testament textual criticism because it's just a field per se, but you do have something called block texts. So
to explain, I don't know what that means.
Well, what that means is you when you reconstruct the textual history, usually, there are different views on this, usually you want to reconstruct the oldest possible version of that.
Yeah.
And so what you come up with is a tree, and when you have larger groups of branches, you group the text group themselves like that, and manuscripts usually align. But in such a large book like Codex Sinaiticus, a whole Bible, you find that from the beginning of one gospel to the middle of the next, that's equivalent to this branch, but then suddenly it goes to another branch of textual history. So it how do you explain that? Well, either the copy they took as a point of departure was a mixed copy or was fragmentary, and so they had to use different ones, or maybe it was. I mean, this was a professional setup. I mean, the scribes that wrote this were professionals. They weren't, your standard village letter writer. It was a scriptorium-like setup.
Were you surprised that the binding came, I can't remember how many said, were bound together, folded and bound together, each choir?
In choirs.
Was that the standard way of doing it? that.
Well, we don't know much about standards at that time, that early time, because there are not many survivors. So we take that as being, if not a standard, at least a very advanced form of it. Certainly caught on. It's difficult to say because there's so little left over. Previous, you know, before the Codex Sinaiticus was written. And this, that's the reason why it is just the more important to understand what is going on. How was it put together? How was work distributed? Did each scribe mix his or her own ink, for example? What went into the ink? That's a big question. It would be easy to research if we were allowed to do destructive testing. Obviously we're not, and that's a good thing. So we have to use other means to do analysis. And we are in the process of doing so. Just one page, sir.
Sorry, I didn't miss just one page.
Yes, I know. I've heard it so often. Just one little bit, nobody will miss it. But no, will never happen.
Just have one. I was just wondering, how are you picking up your comments? I mean, did you set yourself up? These comments that people are making out there on the web, do you have a kind of mechanism, or are you Googling every day to see if there are mentions, or how are you finding stuff?
Well, two ways. The most common way is people actually contact me.
And you put a contact thing on the
big
website, did you?
my account is full every day. I have to empty it and so on, and I have to see how to group them if I answer them and so on. Lucky enough, most of the questions seem to be the same, so I can write some group emails if I get through. The other one is the blog and the blog reaction. The two reviews were in two blogs.
But how did you find them?
Well, one of them, basically people alerted me to it. I'm subscribed to one of the blogs in my blog aggregator, and the other one was simply somebody wrote an email and say, did you find it?
Will you be documenting that process? Because we all talk about feedback, but I'm terribly aware that we're not terribly well set up for it.
Yeah.
And I think that your particular experience, because this is something which is going to have a lot of feedback,
yes.
but also feedback at all sorts of different levels,
yes.
It would be extremely useful to have your account, you know, is it just the first few weeks and then it stops?
Yeah.
What are the things that spark it off again? It would be a really useful thing to have, I think.
I'm very interested in that. To be honest, we didn't, because we thought it would be a soft launch, and the big, it's a crescendo towards the big finale, and there we come with, you know, the whole, because some of the leaves, I didn't say this, some of the leaves from Sinai most of them have never been published, and they're important, and very few scholars are allowed to see them. So, you know, the people tipping their desks and in great anticipation. So next July hopefully will be big again in terms of response. I guess the advantage is that we are having responses, and I will have to think about this, because for other projects, possibly larger projects, as in more manuscripts, more diverse, it will need to be set up in a more structured way, I would argue. And there are technologies that help with that.
Just in terms of being alerted to blogs that are mentioning your site, even something as very simple as subscribing to a search for your some keyword.
Sorry, I do that.
Yahoo News. Interestingly, I set my blog aggregator does a search for digital classicists every day, and anyone who blogs digital classicists anywhere in the world will get sent to my aggregator. And 1 week ago and 3 weeks ago, when the two seminars we had here just happened to be ethnographic in nature, I had blogged those seminars before they happened as an announcement of them on the epigraphy blog that I don't contribute to a biblical blog of any kind, so I didn't blog this one. But the number of people elsewhere who in return blogged that this was happening,
right.
Was up in the dozens for those ones.
Right.
It was like two or three for this one.
Right.
Not because this was any less interesting, it was demonstrative. But the interesting thing was, it wasn't on a blog that they found it.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting lesson.
That's the point. I haven't thought of using the blog aggregator to I've done it for news. And that worked quite well with both Yahoo and Google Alerts. So that's interesting. But responses. Mm.
We all want to do that. How was it done? It's not done on the fly.
It's not done on the fly, as in as you ask for it, it's not calculated. Although I have to qualify that. Basically, what we have is the following. We have, obviously, the image. We have an XML file with the transcription. Each word has an ID. And then we have an alignment file that links each word to at least two corners. It's a rectangle with two corners on the image. And that is recalculated with magnification.
So you actually desegment the images. The images manually, word by word.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how is this done?
Yes.
Well, if you have something as nicely written, as professionally done as this, you can actually, believe it or not, train an OCR program that goes a long way. It needed quite a bit of manual correction.
So you did use an OCR and then you corrected
it? Yeah. It was the... No. It's an open source one, very famous.
No.
There's an article by Saeed.
But you can only do it for really very beautifully written texts.
It's one. I'll come back to you.
So the dreadful, although as you say, the script is very clear and very well done and systematic. It's still a scripture continua, so you don't have.
Well, the letters are not. I know what you mean. The letters rarely join up. And they're beautifully, you know, one alpha looks like the other. It's really remarkable. Very, very close to each other. And this program went a very long way, and that helped. But the information we have are part, I mean, we know the corner points of each column, the corner points of the page on each image, and then automatically, because the OCR, at least whether it read it correctly or not, it could recognize where the first letter is and the last letter. We knew the coordinates of each line.
So you also did some additional line.
So that's part of it. But I think each word is literally linked to the image by the corner or two corners, and it could be done so quickly because it's so. I'm looking for the word. Regelmäßig is it?
Regular.
Sounds similar.
And the other question I want to ask is about the search. I haven't seen the website, and I will.
You'll have more hits tonight.
The search.
So the very simple search. Are you planning to have any advanced search?
Yes.
But what I meant was more like, for instance, did you search the Greek as well as the translation or some gynecological feature?
I mean, what it can do now is obviously it can do a standard text search on everything there, including the transcription. So you can search Greek text and words next to each other, phrases and so on. You can use some wildcards, but it only goes a certain way, and it doesn't use the XML repository to its strength. We anticipate to add something like you want to look for certain features for certain scribes. So we tell you the four scribes, and this is what they've written, and you can search for certain patterns within those scribes. Because what happens with scribes is they develop habits, and they tend to make certain mistakes more than other mistakes. And you can almost create a profile. There's a beautiful 1,000 pages thesis on this just published. on these global habits. And so we hope, this is another answer to your question, I guess. We hope that that is something that can be used towards understanding better scribes. How did it work? I mean, one of the questions, which I think we have an answer for, but we're not 100% sure, is was it dictated or was it copied by looking at an origin? And you would think, well, that's easy, you know, because there are mistakes that are phonetic, so clearly it must have been read. But then there are theories like, well, there's the sort of reading to yourself, mental reading, and that could. So there's quite a discussion going on there. I'm digressing, I notice. But I mean, that's the line of search we want to facilitate, the line of research we want to approach.
When the whole blocks are recopied, which happens in my text, then I think you can say that he's copying. But other times, one's almost sure that it's actually dictated.
Yeah. It is sometimes, yeah.
Okay, I think we should let Juan off the hook and thank him. We can still carry on interrogating him, but in a less formal manner, and also with the sound recording off, so then you can ask him all the embarrassing questions that you didn't want him to respond to on record.
I thought it was off the whole time.
And let's thank Juan once again for an excellent presentation, and I'm quite sure he'd be happy to talk about this subject for a long time.